Hello, is Judge West? Hello.
Hi, sorry, this is, I had it muted. This is Holly Howard. I think we are the only two on the call so far.
Oh, okay. All right.
I just said, I had called, it said it'll start once one other person joins.
I see. Okay. How are you today?
I'm good. It's
first day back
from a vacation. I'm in Florida.
Good. Well, I'm in Richmond, Virginia, and we've had rain. I'm in Richmond, Virginia, and we've had a lot of rain here.
Oh, that's too bad, although we could probably use that rain that you're having. We're having a lack of rain spell.
Really? It's about 50 degrees. It feels like winter.
Oh, sorry.
Sorry,
I won't tell you what it was here today.
Well, I use my imagination and pretend that I'm in Florida.
There you go. And you guys are on the upswing no matter what. It's going to be better weather soon.
Yeah. Where are you in Florida?
I'm in between Sarasota and Tampa.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the West Coast.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, right around the Gulf.
Yeah. It's a beautiful area. I feel very lucky. I grew up in Boston, so
I'm grateful
every day for
what
we have here.
Yeah. It's been a while since I've been to Tampa. My gosh.
Well, hey, welcome back from our bye week last week. It's great to be back together again. I hope you are progressing with your writing. I'm eager to hear any progress notes or questions or clarifications from our first two seminars. Any follow-up or any application or questions from anyone?
No, I don't have any questions.
This is who?
This is George West.
Welcome. Go ahead.
Yeah, I found your instructions very helpful, and I've just been following that, and just trying to discipline myself and keep writing. So I've been stimulated by the process. So,
okay.
I don't have any questions.
How have you found that process of just structuring, having a plan and sticking to it and not waiting for inspiration or motivation?
Well, I really found that I'm energized by sticking to it and getting having a sense of completing a task. You know, I've been energized by that. You know, it's helped me to be give my writing more, or my it helped to structure, give me a sense of structure.
Well, super. You know, that's really an application of what we've come to know and appreciate and do regularly in coaching, is to shrink the change, to look at a next step, to create a framework in which there is a tangible, specific next best action that establishes a model of effectiveness, that when there is a specific, tangible, measurable goal, there's the experience of effectiveness, and that's a model then that's internalized by the client, and that enhances application and motivation to want to continue. So I thought about this after we ended last time and didn't really have time for this, but there's one other thing this is not in your outline, but this is sort of from appreciative inquiry for any kind of stuckness. And this is coming from just hearing a client say, well, I'm really stuck about this. And this is an application to any of your writing. So consider these questions, whether you're working with a client or whether your best client is yourself or your best coach is yourself in terms of the writing. whenever a client says, well, what I really want is blank. So if you're saying what I really want is to write productively, or even more specifically, a plan and a way to measure that. So here are some questions, some sort of appreciative inquiry questions whenever you hear yourself or a client say, what I really want is blank. What would we observe to know that that's what you want? When you're working with a client, you want to continue that collaborative model, which is unique to professional coaching, from all other professions. It's a collaboration. So what would we together observe to know that you want that? In other words, is there any action that you're taking, or is this just a good idea? Secondly, what behavior would demonstrate that you're acting to do that? And then, is there a component that you could begin right now? And remember, the reason that we do whatever we do is how we imagine we're going to feel when we do it. So a question can be, can you describe how you'd feel when you do what you want to do or plan to do? And then, we haven't really talked about this, but there are two primary motivations that people have that are biologically wired: the desire to seek pleasure and the desire to avoid pain. Of the two, avoiding pain is more powerful because there's a loss aversion. We experience twice as much pain when we lose $100 as pleasure when we gain $100. So we'll do more to avoid pain. So if there's something that you're not doing, or something you hear your client not doing, and of course the first question is, do you have a plan? If you have a plan, if the client has a plan, then there's some pain that is being associated with proceeding that would be helpful to know. And it may be a shadow story, such as the surface story is, I want to generate more money and create wealth. The shadow story is, well, I don't think I really know how to do it, or I'm not sure how to do it. Or, if it's writing, I want to write a book. And the shadow story is, well, I just need to do blank before I start, or I need to have some ideas, or I need to do some more research. All of those ways of stopping are simply ways of stopping. So the shadow story is avoiding some kind of pain that may not be conscious. Remember, 90 to 95% neuroscientists tell us of our operating system is unconscious. So there's a shadow story that may not be conscious, may not be logical and make sense, that you're stopping yourself. So a coaching perspective from that would be staying in a very here and now and making a shadow story more conscious. What's the greater pain if you don't proceed? And what's the greater pleasure if you do? So that there's more of an alignment of mind and brain with plan, and you not circumvent the shadow story, but you inhabit the surface story and make components of it more conscious. So those are just some things to think about if you notice any stuckness. We're going to be talking today about state of mind, and really the science of writing is what we're supposed to be talking about today, but really some about state of mind, because I think that is the most crucial aspect of coaching as well as of writing. So this is, I think, some important aspects of what we're going to be talking about. So any other questions or comments or anything else you'd like to talk about briefly before we begin our topic for today?
David, hi, it's Spencer calling.
Hey, first of all,
I want to know if you won the marathon.
Hey, remember the story that I mentioned about the two anthropologists who lived in an ape colony, lived for a year, and emerged to compare results because of their philosophy, training, education, all of that being similar, they expected remarkably similar results. And what they found when they emerged was two very different results. One had a remarkable connection with the ape colony, got significant data, achieved a comfort and an intimacy with the ape colony. The other anthropologist never achieved any harmony, never got to a position of comfort. And they and their teams puzzled for months until they finally found one difference. And remember, the difference was the anthropologist who was the outsider, who never got the comfort, had a gun. He never used the gun. The apes never saw the gun. But he knew he had a gun. He had an out. And in retrospect and reconstruction, having an out colored every aspect of his story, and the other anthropologist had no out. He was immersed, and that determined his story. So we tell our story, and then our story tells us. From the preface to this, that's the preface to the preface. The preface now is the week before I did a presentation, an actual full-day workshop to the New England ICF group. And my daughter was able to attend, and she lives and practices in Lexington, a suburb of Boston. And that was I was really excited, because that was the first time that she's been able to attend anything that I've done since she was in Boston College, you know, a decade and a half ago, and attended a keynote I did for a Harvard Medical Conference. Well, she attended that conference. She texted me right before she started that, you know, I listened to the anthropologist story. This is the first year I haven't had a credit card in my back pocket. Meaning, she planned to make it. She didn't have an out. She took away her out to take an Uber in case she didn't make it, or a cab. So it affected her. She had a great run, even better than ever. So yeah, thanks for asking. And it was a terrific time. So thank you. Yeah. How are you doing, Spencer?
I'm good. Are we going to have a chance to talk about our respective progress?
Yeah. Go for it.
No, I don't want to break up your plan.
Yeah,
but
go ahead.
If
there's anything that I think is important that I don't cover, I'll dictate it and send it to you guys. So, and I would love to have the entire series a true seminar of give and take. There's just so much information I want to convey to you that I, you know, try to, you know, I of course suffer from the curse of knowledge, as I mentioned last time. Go ahead. What's going on?
All right. Well, I have a lot of nonfiction books as well as fiction, and I walked by my nonfiction bookcase and pulled out a book that I bought probably about 15 years ago and thought I'd read it. It's a very much tome-like, and I've only scratched it, but it's Elias Canetti's Crowds and Power, and it's the basis of fear, looking at it historically, and what happens when we become overpopulated. We're like rats, and we start to eat each other. So I thought that was perfect. So now I'm dumbing it down, the fear, but I want to do an e-book to answer your questions. The title would be Fear, and a working subtitle is How to Stop It from Hijacking Your Life. And other than design it, which I have done on the computer, the cover, that's as far as I've gotten. But I want to know what your intent is for us. I mean, I'd like to make this a completed working project at some point, and want to know if you'll be available to us somehow to cast some opinions and feelings and all of that on our respective work.
Okay, let me back into that by saying I think that's a great start. I think it was no accident that of the hundreds and hundreds of books you have that you...
No, David, not hundreds.
I'm sorry?
Not hundreds and hundreds, but, you know, maybe a hundred.
You've got a bunch of books. Okay, let's use a Texas literary term. You've got a bunch of books, and there's some reason now at this time that you picked that particular book, and that fits into some flow that you have, even more now conscious that you're going to ultimately channel into a creative product and structure it and plan it for a book. So
correct.
I think that's great. Now, I'm not able to offer individual editing or work as part of this workshop. That's why I wanted to submit for you as much as possible the detailed notes for the outline and the couple of references I would highly recommend about how to write a book proposal, because that's going to be helpful whatever kind of book you do. And even if you don't do traditional publishing and submit to an agent, that's going to be, as I mentioned, the backbone of the book.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I do mentor coaching with authors, and I'll be happy to work with any of you if you'd like in a coaching capacity. So I always create a priority and my lowest fee for people I've trained. So if that's an answer, absolutely. I'd love to work with any of you who would like to, you know, further what you do and work with me in that way, sure.
Great. But we could be in touch with you and just send it to you. You could bless it or put it in the toilet, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I got my own little holy water here and at the ranch. So either way, yeah.
All right. I need to steal a lot of your time. Thank you, David.
Okay, that's great. Any other questions or comments before we move into the material? Okay, we're in lecture mode now. We're talking in this seminar about the science of writing, truly the neuroscience of writing. Remember I mentioned also last time an introduction to this really in the brain science of story about the neuroscience secret of a successful story, about what draws us into a story, sustains our engagement, what do we respond to consciously and unconsciously both, and ultimately what determines bestsellers from non-sellers. And it's the key element of we want to know what happens next. As a reader or listener, we're engaged, and that fires our dopamine system to sustain our interest, to want to know what happens next. So keep that in mind as a way of listening from your reader's perspective. So back to you now, the author. First, I want to talk about your comfort zone. To write and publish your first book, you're going to have to leave your comfort zone. A comfort zone is simply a familiar pattern of behavior. It's a gradual process initially, but once established, resists change. Think of a comfort zone like your home thermostat. An increase or decrease in room temperature, even a little bit, an immediate signal to adjust to return to the set point, the comfort zone. Our minds and brains both contribute to the maintenance of that comfort zone. We return to the familiar even if we don't like it or when it's uncomfortable, it's just familiar. And for our mind software, there's a familiarity that can read as effectiveness. Repetition can masquerade as effectiveness. And once we do something in a repeated way, then our brains create neural networks and wiring to make that become automatic. So we know the outcome of it. A comfort zone can be repeated ways you engage in a relationship, attachment patterns, or a repeated pattern like even procrastinating about needed lifestyle changes. It can take a bunch of different forms. Anything that you repeat, bargaining with yourself about seriously writing or completing your book within a specific time frame. Now, in the beginning, a departure from a comfort zone feels, by definition, uncomfortable. It's a rupture of continuity. A routine is broken. Remember that a habit is not a definition, it's a choice that gets repeated. When we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains. Here's a study that some of you have heard, I know. Some NASA astronauts did a training experiment in which they wore headgear with a visual apparatus that gave an upside-down image consistently 24 hours a day. Everything was absolutely reversed with that headgear, and they were always in it. So they had to very carefully adjust what they did. They had to think through every movement that they made. Then they noticed something remarkable. At day 25, plus or minus a few hours for each of them, their brains automatically made the adjustments. They didn't have to anymore. Their brains had rewired, developed new neural pathways. Now, another group of the astronauts were given a day off out of the helmets for 24 hours at day 15. When they put the helmet back on, it took them 25 days from that point on for their brains to rewire. So that's the role, not only the remarkable role of neuroplasticity, but also the importance of consistency in creating a new story or a new habit. Your performance, even the money you make, operates in a similar way. If people get more successful, they may feel vaguely uncomfortable, different. If you make more money than fits with your self-image, it can cue an internal thermostat to return to the comfort zone. Here's an example of that in action. Most lottery winners manage to spend or give away their newfound earnings to return to their previous situation. In the U.S., just over 80% of lottery winners of $3 million or more file bankruptcy within the first 5 years after they win. A comfort zone is an unconscious thermostat until it becomes conscious. Their money changed, but their mindset didn't. Once it becomes conscious, you can reprogram your mind and your brain. And your mind can reframe, your brain can rewire. So, one possibility here. Make a habit of writing. Construct a schedule and be loyal to that, as we heard from George. So let's talk about frame here. How you frame something can change the meaning. The meaning can change your mind, and your mind can change your brain. Meaning derives from the frame we place around an event or a situation. So the structure of meaning, then, is an inside job. It's what we determine. It's part of our story. If a traumatized combat veteran hears a car backfire, the stimulus creates an immediate firing of a kindling in his amygdala that produces a startle response, which transports him in a nanosecond to a different state of mind. Now, to his companion right beside him with a different history, it's a background noise that may not even interrupt the conversation for him. Each meaning and each frame is yours to construct. It's not there until you create it. Here's a simple example. I've just got too much going on right now to find time to write. Reframed. I have too much going on right now not to create specific scheduled time to write. It's a way I take care of myself, or even it's a way I live into my ideal. So your response, your perception of an experience and a meaning you attribute to it, that's the bridge between an external event and your internal state. To discern meaning, you have to have a context to surround it. The frame can determine your state of mind. The reticular activating system at the base of your brain decides what's allowed into consciousness out of the hundreds of bits of information that stream into your brain every day. For example, right now, pay attention to your feet. Focus specifically on how your feet feel as you wiggle your toes, as you move your feet back and forth on the floor. Now, your feet have been there all along, but you cue your reticular activating system to attend to your feet, and you get feedback. Whatever you focus on is where you generate feedback. You pay attention to whatever fits your life story, the framework you use. Now, let's examine how this affects the story of your book, of your writing. For example, part of your life story is your self-image. If somebody says something really nice about you that you don't believe or doesn't fit your self-image, it either won't register or it'll be disavowed with an internal comment like, well, what are they trying to sell me? So natural filters include beliefs, self-image, even goals. So the question, how do you reframe, how do you reprogram your reticular activating system to let in what you want to achieve with your book? Now, here's the key to this entire discussion on frame. Your book outline is more than your blueprint and plan. It's your frame. When you start writing about something specific, you'll notice examples of it just begin to appear. Like Spencer just happened to go to that book out of an entire library that he has available. Even if there were only six, there was some reason he went to that one, but still, okay, just in case he wanted to say anything about that. When you start writing specifically, you'll see examples. It's as if the universe is conspiring to help you achieve your goal. Yellow Jeeps began to appear. You can't get away from them. I first had a series of experiences doing psychoanalysis that I've now had in mentor coaching as well that I wanted to mention that kind of illustrates this principle. My patients at the time who were therapists or psychologists, psychiatrists, psychoanalysts, particularly psychoanalysts in training, would notice that as soon as they worked through an issue and came to terms with it, suddenly there were a half a dozen of their own patients who would bring up the issue that they had just dealt with. Their patients had been unconsciously taking a number, patiently waiting until their therapist or their analyst worked through it and could help them, until it was their turn. Those of you who are professional coaches no doubt have noticed and will notice the same thing with your clients. They'll wait for you to get your arms around something so you can then help them with it. They unconsciously take a number. Now, as authors, you're going to notice this again, and it will pertain to what you're writing. For example, suddenly, in the first couple of months after the release of The Secret Language of Money, along with, at the same time that added to it, I think, beginning a licensed specialty certified training program for financial coaches and money coaches, my clients began giving me illustrations. Their money stories were there at center stage needing to be coached, and it just happened to be on the subject of my sequel. That's what the law of attraction tells us. Whatever you focus on, you will both notice and create, bring about. So here's a three-step combination to reframe and incorporate your new endeavor. First, visualization. You can create powerful and stimulating internal images. Or, now remember, for those of you who are not a visual organizer, if you're more auditory, create conversations that depict the success scenario you want to live into. Visualization, or whatever form it takes for you, reprograms your reticular activating system by programming awareness. It cues your radar. Affirmations, the positive validation of doing and being what you want, are the stories that support the visualization. The affirmations are the revision of your mind software. The visualizations are the rewiring of your brain. Affirmations constitute the story that frames and supports the visualization. So, to allow yourself to be creative, you have to lose the fear of being wrong. Affirmations will provide a sense of safety as well as of hope, and provides a focus and a repetition that you can live into. The second of the three-step combination, change your behavior to precisely what you want. It's not there until you create it. Every day is a blank page. You might as well create it to be what you want it to be. New behavior and new experiences create new pathways in the brain. With each repetition, those pathways become more deeply etched. As soon as they're well grooved, you'll have a new habit, an automatic behavior, the default mode. But first you have to work at it until it becomes the default mode consistently. Your future self lives in your present mind. If you clearly visualize that future self, you can then move ahead to actualize that vision. Creating a vision is a future memory that you simply back into. So here's the science of a vision. Recent positron emission tomography, PET scans, of the brain have confirmed several things about visualization. Visualization brings about actual physical changes in the brain. In other words, the same thing happens in your brain whether you visualize it or whether the image comes through your optic nerve, whether you actually see it. The brain assimilates that mental picture, whether the stimulus is actual or imagined, from the optic nerve or the prefrontal cortex. The brain can't tell the difference between that mental image and an actual image. Same firing. Replays of the visualization, such as repeating the vision of having successfully attained your goal, programs neural networks and neuronal pathways to more strongly etch the experience. And PET scans have established that thoughts bring about physical changes in your brain. When you program your unconscious, you create that future memory to live into. And your brain can't tell who conjured it. You or external reality, they're both forms of reality. The more detailed your visual image, the more specifically etched your brain will be. Now here's the important part. You don't make the brain change permanent unless you incorporate it into your story. It has to become part of your identity, part of who you are. The transformation of your behavior also has to have a corresponding transformation of your sense of yourself, your identity, your working model. To say that a different way, one of the most powerful forces of the human psyche is that we return to our identity. So if you simply create a behavior change and don't in a corresponding way also create a change in the model of how and who you see yourself to be, that change won't be permanent. You'll revert back to your identity. Let me give you a common example. This is most likely why just over 95% of people who diet and gain significant weight, who diet and lose significant weight, gain back their weight. They don't reprogram their body image, their operating model of their body. So, envision the experience of your completed book. Now, not of getting there, but of being there. This is creating a vision, a success scenario. The experience of your completed book, of being there, of announcing its successful release, the entire experience of the successful completion of it. This is a way to incorporate and what you want to do with it, how you see it. Do you see it at Barnes & Noble? Do you see it at the back as you're doing of the room as you're doing a present? We're going to talk about all those variations next time. So this is a way to incorporate your objective as part of your identity, to transform your operating model rather than it just being something that happened or, you know, it was a piece of behavior. We know that by simply picturing a danger, we can trigger the entire body responses of fight and flight. When you picture a success, you change the biochemistry and ultimately the biology of your brain. While your unconscious mind can't tell the difference between something you physically see and something you mentally picture, your conscious mind can. So your conscious mind has to incorporate this evolving story to assemble the imagery and this new self-concept as part of your new story. Otherwise, it doesn't register, or it's extruded as noise or just a happenstance or luck. So this is how you reprogram your brain to incorporate the behavior as part of who you now really are. So there are three key elements, to put this very simplistically, but it's very adequate. Three key elements. Repetition. The neural networks dedicated to your vision have to be renewed and repeated regularly, or they'll be eliminated. Two, conscious incorporation of this new vision into your ongoing story to be ultimately metabolized as part of yourself, as part of who you really are. I'm an author. Otherwise, you'll lose the vision. And thirdly, specificity about the experience of having achieved the goal. Specifically illuminate, specifically determine exactly what it's going to be like to finish that goal in whatever language you put it, whether it's in pictures, in words, in experience. Visualization crystallizes possibility into an articulated idea. The experience changes the brain. So a vision serves as guide and inspiration to design ways to realize it, to live into it. A simple example here. Major James Nesmith spent 7 years as a prisoner of war in North Vietnam. During the time he was in prison, he was essentially isolated and had no physical activity. Now, before the war, Major Nesmith was an average weekend golfer. He had broken 100 on two occasions. He had 299s. Everything else for years and years was in the triple digits. So to preserve his sanity, he learned to visualize golf. He selected his favorite golf course, got in the car, drove there each day in his mind, got out, warmed up, smelled the flowers, looked at the sky, made the stroke, walked to the next, did this for about 7 hours each day for 7 years. After he was released from his captivity, his first outing, he shot a 74. The power of a vision of mind over matters. Now, let's look a little bit at states of mind. And I want to emphasize the importance of this specifically to frame your writing, to get in state for writing. And this is the most important preparation you can do after you plan and schedule your writing, is to get in the best state for your writing, for the creative state of writing. Now, when you want to edit, you'll need to get in a different state for editing. It's a different part of the brain. So let's talk about states of mind now. We enter and leave states of mind fluidly and invisibly, sort of like a precision baton passing between relay team members. Each of us has a number of sets of different states of mind: relaxation, alertness, anxiety, anger, centered attention, confidence. A state of mind is a psychophysiological state. It's an internally organized software program. And just like any software program, it has a total set of expectations, attitudes, meanings, feelings, a whole number of characteristics, algorithms that are unique to that state of mind. So from an infinite sea of stimuli, the unique software package of each state of mind determines what we take in as data, the patterns that we see that fit the algorithms of that state, and once those data become input, how processing occurs. Each mind-body state determines how we perceive and process information and how we respond. So a key element is our awareness of different states of mind in order to know what works best for which purpose. For example, creative writing, editing, two different states of mind. Brainstorming, completing a project, different states of mind. So the regulation of feelings and states of mind involves the understanding and mastery of access to each of your different states of mind. So I want to just share some examples of how different artists and authors learned for each of them to enter a creative state to fit their specific work. Some of these sound goofy, but they'll give you an illustration. Dame Edith Sitwell would lie in the stale solitude of an open coffin as a prelude to entering the state of mind she needed to write her macabre literature. Dr. Samuel Johnson and poet W.H. Auden maintained a continuous state of stimulation by constantly consuming tea as they wrote. Willa Cather read the Bible to set the right tone for her prior to her writing. George Sand went from immediately making love to writing. Voltaire used his lover's back for a writing desk. Benjamin Franklin and one of my favorite nonfiction authors, Diane Ackerman, wrote while soaking in the bathtub on a pine plank to get that floaty, warm feeling that stimulated a creative state of mind for them. Coleridge used opium before each stint of writing. The painter Turner liked to be lashed to the mast of a ship and taken for a sail during an incredible storm so he could then come back and recreate his experience on canvas. Some authors play a piece of music repeatedly during the course of writing to create an emotional framework to house their evolving story. The corresponding state of mind in the reader often matches with that of the author. The author guides the reader to that state of mind through the senses, the music and voice of the words, the texture of imagery, the rhythm of feelings. Each of us has a continuum of states with some level of awareness of what state works best for what endeavor, even of how to enter and exit different states. We become more or less cognizant of which state to enter, for example, to be more effective in going to sleep. We may have a way of a relaxation and a focused phrase that's very different than being in an optimum state for a keynote with a very different optimizing focused phrase and relaxation for that. So I want to talk just briefly about how to regulate states of mind. The most important thing we can do to achieve success, I believe, is to manage emotions and regulate states of mind. That is the most common issue that I see in working with clients. It definitely is important in any endeavor you do, and specifically for writing. Consider this. What do these people have in common? John Belushi, Marilyn Monroe, Elvis Presley, Janis Joplin, F. Scott Fitzgerald. They never learned the crucial success strategy of regulating their states of mind. Using drugs, alcohol, or some other addictive substance or process to regulate a state of mind and manage emotions can lead to significant compromise. Your state of mind, the particular software program you use, determines the meaning you attach to a stimulus. The meaning then determines your behavior. And there are two primary ways to regulate a state of mind: focus and physiology. Focus is what and how you focus. Physiology is how you use your body. And there are two exercises in the outline about how to get centered in your body and your experience, and a brief on your feet grounding exercise. So basically, the most effective and efficient way is simply a mantra. And let me give you an example of what I mean by a mantra. When Southern Utah University's new basketball coach, Robert Reed, arrived, his team ranked 217th in three-shot percentage, lowest in the division nationwide. So, during practice, Reed had his players develop a mantra, a three-part exercise that they would do immediately before shooting each free throw. He suggested the cue be dribbling the basketball twice, the focus be a phrase that they repeat something like relaxed and smooth, but he emphasized they do their own phrase, and a physiology. One deep breath for relaxation and breathing out any tension. So before each free shot of every practice, they would do the cue, dribble twice, the focus, the phrase relaxed and smooth, or their variation of it, and a deep breath for relaxation and exhaling any tension. In 2 years, they were number one in their division of 217 teams. So, mantras can be used in various situations to regulate states of mind, especially for emotional triggers that can cue an instantaneous state change. So mantra can both calm as well as keep you from overthinking in high-pressure situations. Let me give you an example of what I do before a presentation. I will simply put my index finger and thumb together on both hands, except because I don't carry a basketball around, and touch them in the middle so it forms this little infinity sign. And I, if it's a keynote, for example, it'll be relaxed and powerful. And then I do two deep breaths, in for relaxation, out for any tension. So in about 5 or 6 seconds, I'm at an optimum state of mind for what I want to do for peak performance. Now, if I want to go to sleep more effectively, I may simply substitute a phrase like relaxed to sleep and focus on entering a very different state. Remember, we have all kinds of states. So the most effective and efficient way to enter each one and to match that for exactly what you want to do, I think, is key. So let's look for just a couple of moments at creativity, because this is the product as well as a state of mind. Inside each of us is a natural, innate energy, a drive to create. When we open ourselves to creativity, we allow our internal experience to flow through whatever channels are natural for us, words, pictures, movement. Creativity is a natural part of life. So for flow, to access a creative experience, you need to enter the state of mind that allows that flow. Flow is a state of heightened productivity, awareness, happiness, the ability. There's a whole, in the last couple of decades, there's been a whole division and science of psychology devoted to the psychology of flow, which is really, in one way of looking at it, the state of mind of flow. To be more productive, creative, satisfied. Flow is one of the positive states that contributes so much to effectiveness and performance. From another perspective, flow is a state of mind of being centered and focused without distraction. And this state of mind allows full immersion in the process of concentration and performance that creates superior results. So think about the combination of what we talked about last time of framing the time, the commitment, the structure of when you do work, and then entering the state of mind that's going to be most productive for that designated time. You have a plan, you stick to it, you enter a state of mind that's optimally productive. So in a state of mind of flow, people engage so fully in what they do, they usually lose track of time because the experience becomes its own reward. It's a way of countering distraction and becoming immersed in purpose. Now, so here are some things that can interfere with this creative process. These are obstacles to become aware of, because these obstacles that I'm about to mention are not the problem. The problem is that you stop yourself and change your state of mind to one of choking or blocking or stopping that creative flow. Just simply stopping it. And here's evidence that you have stopped and moved away from that creative flow, waiting until it's the right time. waiting until you really have something to say, waiting until you have enough money to justify the time, telling yourself it's too late, being concerned about what family or friends might think, thinking that an appointment with yourself for creative time is an indulgence or a luxury. Remember, these are indications that you have stopped that state, and this is all the content of an altered state, of moving away from a creative state. So the problem is stopping that creative state to get into it and sustain it. Now, in the beginning, it's not about where you sit, what paper you use, what you write about. In the beginning, it's about beginning. In the beginning, your job is to begin. A recommendation here. Consider integrating your writing into other professional activities. We've already discussed how you'll begin to hear vignettes and illustrations to capture that. Another strategy, present what you're writing about. When I'm working on a book, I'll only accept speaking engagements that are in the flow of what I'm writing about, so that when I'm working on a presentation, I'm also working on a chapter or chapters. When I accepted the recent presentation that I mentioned to the New England ICF group, it's in the flow of a book I started last September in my month sabbatical in the old restored house in the French Quarter, and what I'll return to in September. So it was part of that process. The retreat that I'm about to do, that I'm going to mention and send you guys a link to, it's a 3-day live retreat in California. It's in a beautiful resort area in the Redwoods with all kind of hiking trails and natural food. It's in the same genre. It's in the same process. So I'll send you a link, and I'm allowed to offer a number of seats before May 20th for people on that. I apologize, actually, for mentioning that. So here's an exercise that I would suggest. Morning pages. Now, this is from Julia Cameron in The Artist's Way. One of the ways to foster this creativity initially is to do what Julia describes as morning pages. Morning pages are 3 pages of longhand writing done first thing in the morning, totally stream of consciousness. She emphasizes there is no wrong way to do them. Just write. Even if you can't think of anything to write, write anyhow. Don't edit, don't judge, just write. The morning pages are a primary tool for just initiating and rediscovering that flow. Don't worry about how it looks. Remember, don't edit and create at the same time. Another point I want to make here. Insight changes the brain. This is an application. It's a result of flow. Both EEG and fMRI monitoring of the brain reveals that at a moment of insight, a new set of neural connections is being created. An aha moment, a moment of insight, lights up 3 different parts of your brain that vault you into a state of mind that is more synthetic, integrative, and creative. Now, contrast this with receiving information, a directive, and an order. Nothing happens in the brain. No portion of the brain lights up. When you solve a problem, neural transmitters immediately respond with a rewarding release. This is your most powerful way to write effectively, is to engage in this flow, the insight, to create a situation that gives you a novel approach. It will be its own reward, and it's more easily accessed and furthered in that optimum state of mind, in the framework that you have. So what this means practically, schedule, protect, preserve the space, the framework for this creativity to live and to unfold. You establish the crucible for this creative force when you set aside time and establish an environment for that time that is free of intrusions or distractions. So you will see in your outline, there's some material about management of issues, specifically about chokes, slumps, and blocks. That information is pretty well self-contained, and I want to just mention something that has been much more recent in terms of some neuroscience research about what we know about deliberate practice, and this is really the best way to avoid those choke slumps. So, for deliberate practice, the question is, are you getting better at the things you most care about? Because there are two distinct mindsets, states of mind here. A learning zone to learn and improve, and a performance zone to execute. So, activities in the learning zone involve specific skills, writing time, focus on a challenge that's beyond your comfort zone, use feedback with repetition and adjustments. And this is what makes deliberate practice instead of just doing the same thing again and again and practicing, which means you're going to get better and have your brain more grooved at doing the same thing, but not necessarily getting better. This may be doing exactly what you're doing now, of getting new information, getting new methods, even engaging the guidance of a skilled coach. So purposeful practice, not talent, is the key to success. This is what some very compelling research by Anders Ericsson and others have shown. Purposeful practice, deliberate practice, is not about talent. It's about purposeful practice. So this is what becomes important. So here's a summary of the neuroscience of writing. Since old patterns are hardwired, consistency of focus on new experiences is what it takes to change this wiring. So concentrate on new behaviors. This is in your outline. Possibilities rather than problems or obstacles in order to create new brain pathways. Identifying the problem won't solve it. Create new ways of thinking to stimulate brain circuits. An eye on the prize, the completed book, to lay new mental maps. Regulate states of mind and manage emotions to promote brain power. New insights and adaptations occur through a balanced brain, left brain and right brain, intellectual and emotional. This is what you get when you get grounded and present. When you have a mantra, you have a grounding and a present that you have access to all of the information and all of your states of mind, which fosters creativity. If you're diverted to an old feeling or behavior or thought, simply redirect. Consider it an error message from your brain. The new story of the process of creative immersion in writing is the focus. Anything else is an error message. Remember that the power is in the focus and that permanent change arises from the consistency of that focus. Focus on successes rather than obstacles or on non-performance, because remember from quantum physics and from neuroscience, we get what we focus on. Focus aligns and directs energy and efforts. Emphasize positive, adaptive behavior and progress. Discourage attention to negative behavior. Knowledge is inert until it's activated. Put it into behavior. And finally, think about your new experience and evolving self. How new experiences will require thinking of yourself, your identity, in a new way, no longer in the old story. Here's how that sounds. I'm an author. Now, I realize we're essentially out of time, but I do want to share this. If you'll indulge me maybe 2 to 2.5 minutes, I want to share some inverse wisdom for authors. These are highlights that I use for the introduction of Outsmart Your Brain and Instruction Manual. Basically, and let's cut to the chase here. I came home from college after my freshman year and announced to my mom that I decided to major in psychology. We talked. She was excited for me. Then she mentioned she'd made an A in her college psychology course. I said, man, I didn't know that. You must have really enjoyed it and studied a lot. She said, no, I just answered everything on the test just the opposite of what I thought it was. Which, if you knew my mom, that was totally accurate, I should have guessed. Well, here's a list of things that are the inverse of conventional wisdom for authors in honor of my mom, who thought it was all opposite anyhow. One, burn your bridges. Make it impossible to go back to an old habit or way of being. If you decide to quit postponing the completion of your book, make it impossible to go back to postponing it. Create an uncomfortable scenario. If you slip back, focus on the present without the limiting belief. Reward yourself for proceeding and not going back. And even if you have writer's block, you don't get to go to the mall during your writing time. Work on the writer's block because that's a state of mind. Two, do the opposite of what you normally do when you're afraid, worried, anxious, uncomfortable, or stuck. If you're uncomfortable with public speaking, avoidance will increase the fear, so embrace it. Do more of it. Join Toastmasters. You have to jump in the water because you can't learn to swim on paper. Three, obstacles reveal desire. Show me an obstacle, and I'll show you a desire. Instead of figuring out a way to sidestep or overcome or go around an obstacle, consider simply not creating it. And here's the key. When you're ready to recognize that you create an obstacle, you're ready to consider the possibility of not creating that. Remember that for your clients as well. Four, discomfort can be a sign of progress. Moving beyond your comfort zone is absolutely necessary for progress. Comfortable is not a place you began. It's not a prerequisite for proceeding. It's a place you ultimately get to when you get better. Moving from a comfort zone is necessary in order to proceed. It's a result, not a beginning. Five, lean into the unknown. If you wonder whether you can write or sell a book because you've never done it, lean into the action of doing it. If you think you're too old to do something, you'll be right. You can tiptoe through life very carefully and arrive safely at death. Six, don't believe every thought you have. I'll never be able to write a book. Thoughts lie a lot. They're an error message from the brain. They're kind of like my Uncle Ted. God rest his soul, or I have to use another example. You don't have to believe every thought that crosses your mind. You're not even stuck with the brain you have. You can make it better. Remember Van Gogh's sage advice. If you hear a voice saying, I'm not a painter, then by all means paint. Then that voice will be silenced. Seven, you don't attract what you want. You create what you focus on. Cue your radar for early recognition. Keep an eye open for yellow jeeps, stories, illustrations for your books, opportunities to talk about what you're writing about. A caveat, talk about your subject, not the book you're writing. Talking about writing your book can dissipate the energy of its writing. How many people do you know who have a book in them? Or, I've been working on my book for the last decade. Eight, you only see what you believe. I'll say that again in a slightly different way. Some things have to be believed in order to be seen. And when you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. This comes from quantum physics and the process of observing quarks. In quantum mechanics as well as in the brain, the question you ask influences the outcome you see. A well-verified law is called the quantum Zeno effect. It says this, the mental act of attention activates and holds in place brain circuitry. Consistent focus then rewires the brain. Use this law to help you write your book. You'll see more of what you need to write about this way. And finally, number nine, believe in someone and he or she will show you why you do. Neuroscience, this is amazing, I think. Neuroscience has demonstrated that an authentic belief in someone activates that person's brain to create a state of mind that transcends usual thinking and performance. And here's the secret. That person can be you, the author. Okay, and you guys manage your time better than I did. We're a few minutes over. We don't have time for discussion, but if there are any things you'd like to discuss, jot them down, and we'll begin there next time. See you next Monday. Thanks very, very much.